You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, Congress is in session today. Finally, you know, they took all of August off. They took the first week of September off. They're going to take off. They're going to be in session for like a week or so. John Boehner, by the way, is the guy who sets the agenda for the House, which has pretty much defined the agenda for both bodies. There have been a couple of times the Senate's been in session when the House wasn't. But it doesn't really matter because the senators passed things like comprehensive immigration reform, and they did. Democratic and Republican senators passed it, sent it to the House of Representatives. Or they passed something like extending long-term unemployment benefits from last Christmas all the way through June, and they did. And they sent it over to the House of Representatives, and it dies because John Boehner won't hold a vote on it. So, you know, it's like, why bother? But anyhow, they're back today. And, you know, on the agenda is whether or not to shut down the government. We'll see. There's two things that they've got to do. They've got to reauthorize federal spending. And the reason why, by the way, that the reauthorization of federal spending has to happen, you know, at least every other year, is because the Constitution forbids Congress from appropriating money for the military for more than 2 years. And so many pieces and dimensions of the federal budget and various federal appropriations end up in the hands of or as part of or affiliated with or whatever the military budget, that it falls into that little whatever you call it. It's not a loophole. This was because the founders did not trust the military, any military. They were the military. George Washington was the general in charge of the Revolutionary War. Thomas Jefferson was the revolutionary who declared the Revolutionary War. I mean, they understood the military, but they did not trust it. So, fascinating stuff. Anyhow, that's going on. Oh, I'm going to be in Seattle this weekend, September 12th. What day of the week is September 12th? Does anybody have a calendar? Is that Friday? That's Friday night. Okay, Friday night I will be in Seattle at Town Hall for a Yes Magazine gig. You can find a link to it over at yesmagazine.org, Y-E-S Magazine. And this is the fourth annual celebration for Yes Magazine. I will be giving a speech, and there's a dinner, and there's a bunch of stuff. You can see it all over at yesmagazine.org. And it should be a lot of fun. And Danielle and Shana will be filling in for me here on Friday because I will be on an airplane. Leaving on a jet plane. Don't know. Oh, yeah. You don't want me singing. Okay. Yeah. I always loved that song. I don't know. It's part of my childhood, I guess. Anyhow, a lot going on. There's a lot of the news. A lot of things that I wanted to talk about. One of the top ones is it's not so much in the news, but it's out there. It's in the web. You know, I mean, this is like gone viral. Is how to interact with the police. Now, this is not a literal how-to. This guy has a couple things wrong. Cops don't have to show you three forms of ID. That's in order to get permission to vote in some states, right? So, you know, he's mixed a few things up. But and the police can break into your home and, you know, just walk right over you if they have reasonable cause to believe that, you know, a crime is happening in your home or that a suspect has fled into your home. They had secondary information that was not strong enough to raise to that level. But does anybody know where this guy was? We should track that down. Anyhow, this guy said no. Now, what's interesting, and I'm going to play the clip for you in just a second. You know, this follows, you know, the Michael Brown shooting and a couple of other shootings and, you know, a black guy in Minneapolis who was just sitting waiting for his kids and he gets roughed up And I mean, there's just all these stories of African-Americans around the country who are just, you know, literally being in public while black and the police come and assault them. And in some cases, kill them. And St. Louis and others. Well, in this case, This fellow says, no, you can't come into my apartment. Now, I'm guessing the reason why he didn't get shot or beat up was, A, he had a camera on the police continuously, and you will hear them asking him about that. And when you watch the video, you can actually, toward the end of it, the cop finally gets smart and or slick or whatever and puts his camera, his flashlight, right into the guy's camera, you know, to basically blind it. But the police knew they were being videotaped, and so they left. And also, it was a white cop and a black cop confronting a black guy in his apartment, which, you know, I think is not inconsequential. And I think this is one of the reasons why diversity in police departments, particularly police departments of the police diverse communities, is not just useful or even important, but necessary. So anyhow, here's the clip. It's rather long, but I think you'll find it fascinating, this guy talking back to the police. And the camera, he's walking up to his door.
Can you turn that off?
No, I can't.
Okay, I said turn it off.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Turn it off.
Do you have a warrant? Hold on. We have a baby here. Okay, let me explain yourself.
Okay, I'm sure at the sheriff's department. We're looking for a wanted felon.
Okay,
he's not
here. Turn that off because I don't know what it is.
It's a cell phone.
You don't put it in my face. Don't put it in my face.
What's your name? Okay. I don't have to tell you that. Do you have a warrant? Okay. First of all, I need three types of ID.
Okay.
Explain who you are, because you could be anybody dressed up in a uniform.
Really?
By the Supreme Court, yes.
You want to play games?
I'm not playing games.
I'm going to drag you out if you.
That's why I'm recording this. Straight to YouTube.
Is there anybody else in the house, man?
No, there's nobody else in the house. There's me and my family.
YouTube.
That's it.
Okay, let me explain it to you, okay? We got a female in the apartment complex, just got beat up by her parolee at large boyfriend.
I watched the whole thing.
You did?
Yes.
Okay. Then why don't you help us and step out and tell us what's going on?
I seen the dude walk off. I seen him. I heard him arguing.
Do you know him?
No, I don't.
I'm being told that you guys are friends with him.
No, I see him in my... he's my neighbor.
Do you have an ID?
As far as that, no, I don't have to describe that to you. Do you have a warrant? Or do you suspect me of committing a crime?
I don't. You could be harboring a fugitive.
I'm not harboring a fugitive.
For all I know.
I'm not.
There's
nobody in here. If you want to check, please go get a warrant. There's nobody else in here.
Sir, just show us ID and then we'll make sure.
I'm not him.
Okay? We don't know what he looks like, okay?
Okay.
Show us your ID,
okay,
guys.
She'll explain to you what he looks like.
Describe what he looks like.
Okay,
she didn't describe what he looks like. I don't have to describe my ID.
Okay, grab your ID.
You have still not performed me three-fourths ID.
I don't know what you've been
watching. Okay, by the Supreme Court is not what I've been watching. It's the law. And right now you guys are in violation of color and law.
Okay.
Because you are at my door with guns. And I feel for my life. I have not committed no crime. This is law. I have not committed a crime.
We're suspecting you of harming a fugitive.
No, I am not harming a fugitive. Because you have no evidence, video or audio, of me having a fugitive. You are going off words.
Okay. That's why we're here, to check it out.
Okay. There is no fugitive. Okay. We're all neighbors here. You need to knock on everybody's door.
Okay. Not if they said they came here.
Okay. No, they didn't come here. Okay. Why would she say he came here?
I don't know.
He didn't come here. I don't know why.
Okay, so you saw him walk away?
He walked away. To the back. Straight to the back. I don't know what's going on in the back. There's another subject.
Okay.
What's going on? I just told you what I seen.
Can we
That's
check
it.
Your house?
Get a warrant.
Would you allow us to check your house?
Get a warrant.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then they close the door and leave. This is remarkable. Now, like I said, I'm not trying to offer you a how-to. And I genuinely believe if he hadn't had a camera or if he hadn't been confronting both a black and a white officer, that, you know, he probably would have been dragged out of the apartment and had the stuffing beat out of him. But, you know, which is not legal, but, you know, happens every day in America. So have you ever had an interaction with the police of that nature?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Inquiring minds want to know, how do they treat you? This is my argument for a more professional and well-paid police force. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Don in Seattle, Washington, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom. That was a fascinating little camera deal there.
Yeah.
I thought speaking so of I wanted to sort of talk about the economy, but I think this is a more interesting topic. Speaking of encounters with the police, I live up here in Shoreline, which is a little community north of Seattle. And a couple of years ago, there was this, I guess, a police chase, if you want to call it, and it happened in the early, I'll try to make this as brief as possible, early in the Sunday morning, and I woke up in my apartment about 3:30 in the morning. I heard these police sirens. It seemed, I was trying to count the number of them. There were eight of them. They all ended up right here in my apartment complex. The most one of the bizarre things I've ever experienced, and an officer jumped out and yelled, "Freeze, police." So I thought, "Whoa, God, maybe there's going to be shooting." And so I just kind of lowered my head behind my mattress in case bullets come start flying through my window. Jeez. And that two days later, I went in down to the office, rental office, and the office lady said that the maintenance guy went with the Shoreline police over the parking lot. They found five handguns in the parking lot. Apparently somebody, there were 15 people occupying a unit in the other building across the parking lot illegally, and one of the women would come and threaten the office lady, and there was a U.S. federal marshal that had come by several days before, and apparently he was looking for two interstate fugitives, and the office lady showed me his card and everything, so I guess they were looking for interstate fugitives, but you know, there was no shooting. It was the strangest thing. And after the officer yelled, but it was like total silence. Then I heard these helicopters flying overhead for about a half an hour, and I don't know if they're police helicopters or drone helicopters or what.
Or news.
Pardon me?
Might have been news reporters, too. They listen to police radios, the scanners, you know, and if they hear something, then the helicopter comes over.
Yeah, and then there was just nothing more that happened after that, and it's just that's...
Yeah,
I've encountered several experiences like this that I won't go into detail, but it's, I don't know if we're becoming a police state or what, or this is like the new Nazi Germany or
yeah,
what.
I don't think so. I think that stuff is all wildly overblown. I think the problem that we have, one of the biggest problems we have in this country, is that we don't invest in our infrastructure. And our police is part of our infrastructure. It's our safety infrastructure. And we don't invest in our police departments other than, giving them hundreds of millions of dollars worth of military hardware, which is stupid. I mean, that's a stupid investment, and it's not even really an investment. It's just an excuse to give money to the military-industrial complex. But if we paid cops better and held them to higher standards, you get better cops and you know, who would actually follow the law. And I'm not just, guessing this. If you look at the countries of Northern Europe and Scandinavia, you see this writ large.
Yeah.
So it's pretty straightforward stuff. But
one more little thing I want to relate to. I have a friend of mine, this African American I've known for years, and he grew up in the Southland, and he was telling me recently about the KKK and whatnot. And I was thinking, African Americans really live in almost constant fear, and I couldn't possibly live that way. And I just wish.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so Don, as a white guy, you're starting to understand white privilege.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
That's pretty impressive. Don, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching us there on Free Speech TV in Seattle. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I should add, I mean, just my own experiences. When I was 15, 16 years old, I was a minor. I think I was 15, maybe I was 16, and I was hitchhiking in Lansing, Michigan, and a police officer stopped me, or a car with two cops in it, two Lansing cops, and they were very nice to me. You know, it didn't occur to me that I should be afraid of the police, and they, everything okay, just wanted to check, you look like a pretty young guy, are you all right? And I was like, I lied about my age and said I didn't have my ID with me, and they let me go. And it didn't occur to me that, A, that was white privilege, white cops, white me, and they just kind of let me go. And had I been, and I was in a sketchy and racially diverse part of town, and I say sketchy as in, there's a fair amount of crime in that part of town. And the reason I probably shouldn't get into all the details, but I discovered after I had left that there was probably, you know, at least a couple of seeds in my pants pocket. And I thought, whoa, you know. So, and then, you know, a couple of years later out in East Lansing, there was an anti-war protest, and the police came out with tear gas and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it never occurred to me that I could die or that the police would be mistreating us other than shooting CS and CN gas at us. And I think that that's why in, what year was Kent State? Was that 71, 72, whenever Kent State was? I think the reason why Kent State was such a shock is that it was a shock for white people, right? This was, Kent State was, you know, when I believe it was four Kent State University students were shot, 1970, thank you, Shano, were shot by the Ohio National Guard. I think that was the moment, and it was a turning point. I think that was the moment when white people said, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is not how it's supposed to go down. And, you know, it's just interesting how we look at these things in retrospect. It's like, you know, all the encounters that I had with police, both, you know, as a hitchhiker, a friend of mine hitchhiked out to Los Angeles. This is when I was 16. And she and I were stuck in Sparks, Nevada. We got arrested in Sparks, Nevada for hitchhiking. They drove us out to the edge of town and dropped us, and there was this lamppost, and people had written on it, been here 16 hours, you know, been here 22 hours, been here 47 hours. And so Kathy and I ended up, you know, chanting Namahe Rinki Kyo for about 20 minutes, and somebody stopped and picked us up, old Native American guy in a rusting out station wagon. But even then, I mean, you know, the police arrested us, but they drove us to the edge of town and let us off. It wasn't, you know, it was never be afraid of the cops. It was just, you know, hey. It's really interesting, A, how our world has changed, but I think more importantly, B, how the experience of white people and people of color in this country is so different when it comes to interactions with the police. I mean, that was the worst that happened to Kathy and me, and I have a feeling if we had not been, you know, young and white, that it might have played out very, very differently. So, anyway. Chris in Corvallis, New Mexico. Or is it Corrales?
Corrales is outside of Albuquerque.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
And in the valley. Hey, thanks for taking my call. But in New Mexico, we have border checks all over the Border Patrol.
Down on the
and
border with Mexico, you mean?
Pull in, and they start quizzing you about everything. Where are you going? You know, where are you coming from? All these questions, and they're intimidating the heck out of the young people because they don't know their rights and the laws. And they'll ask me, where are you going? I say, this way. He says, where are you coming from? I said, this way, and point behind me. And they get real frustrated, but I'm videotaping the whole time. Every time I get pulled over or any kind of interaction, I'm always videotaping.
Are you talking about the Mexican border or the borders with other states?
It's the Mexican border. I mean, we're 60 miles in.
Right. So, okay. Huh. Interesting.
And what they do is, but I recommend everybody videotaping every stop. Every time a cop engages with you, you start videotaping it because All of a sudden you have documentation. That's why they do it in Europe all the time. They have the dash cams because the police are so corrupt over there. You have to protect yourself, and that's the only means we have. But, the police or the Border Patrol guy, he'll ask me, what's in your trailer? I said, private property. And when he's watching me videotape them, they back off and they let you go.
Yeah.
But they really harass the young people. And I recommend young people get smart, videotape every encounter, be polite, and tell them, you know, you can only ask certain questions. I'm an American citizen. That's it. If you don't smell drugs in the car or anything like that, then they have to let you go.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it's very, you know, there was down in the the Texas-Mexico border, there were a couple of or maybe it was the Arizona border. There was a group of scientists who were investigating bats in a cave, and a bunch of these militia guys come up. This was not police. This was the militia. You know, we've had one of their leaders on the show a couple of weeks ago. And they come up with guns and start yelling in Spanish. And these researchers, these scientists are going, huh? Chris, thanks for the call. It's just, it's getting weird.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we got a bunch of people who want to share some stories with us. This should be interesting. Stick around. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Alan in Chattanooga, Tennessee, you got a story you want to share?
Yeah, hi, how are you today?
Good. What's up?
This is the first time I've called in. I listen to your program on a regular basis, but I was calling about an incident I had. I actually grew up in a small town in Illinois, and a friend, I think I was 16 years old at the time, my friend and I were walking to, there's a local grocery store, and we had gone to get cough medicine, and then we came out, and upon walking out of the store, we noticed some police cars in the lot, and we walked through, there was an alley that was adjacent to the store. We walk out, and when we got out into the light, in a more or better lit area, we were pulled over. Cops, there was two squad cars that wheeled up on us, and they told us to get in the car. And I immediately, you know, I took the fence, and I was like, well, we didn't do anything. I haven't done anything. We're just walking back from the store. They said, get in the car. And a long story short, they got us in the car, and they said we fit the description of two men that had just robbed a Caucasian woman. And they said we fit the description. And I asked, well, what do they look like? What do they look like? And they said, well, they were black, and they had on two trench coats. And at the time, I had on a blue, one of those down feather jackets, and my friend had on a jacket that was red, yellow, and blue. Huh. And I said, no way we fit the description. But they asked us a series of questions, and I refused. Actually, at that time, I refused to give them my name. I said, I haven't done anything. Uh-huh. I said, I haven't committed any crimes or anything, and I wouldn't give him my name. My friend was terrified, and so he gave, not only did he give my name, but he gave his name as well and gave him all the information. And they actually came, they let us go after about 10, 15 minutes of questioning, let us go. And in fact, the next day, there was an officer that came to our house, and my father was just, he was livid. And he did pose the question. He said, if these were two white suspects, would you have reacted the way that you have? Because not only did they pick up us, but they picked up, there was about 10 or 12 guys in our community where they picked us all up. And I had a cousin that lived close to where we live, and we were all picked up for the same thing. But that was my first experience of, you know.
So it was like every African-American in the neighborhood who could be grabbed got grabbed.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. I just to add to my story, and I don't want to get into too much detail here, but I was in a part of town where it was really easy to score, pot and other things. I mean, pot was my principal interest back in those days. And, you know, looking back on it, I'm wondering now if what the police were really saying to me is, you're a white guy in a mostly black neighborhood, are you okay? Because they were so nice to me. And, you know, it's just like, you know, I was 16. I had frankly not even thought about that incident until today. I mean, probably in 20 years. But it's like, this is white privilege on my end, and it's the apparently the lack of it on your end, if I have that right, Alan.
Oh, sure. And I, you know, the high school and all the schools I went to were probably about 95% white. And there was a grocery store where we used to go at lunchtime. And some of the other black kids, we used to go there as well. And we would always watch to see. We would actually see kids, you know, some of our white friends, they would go in and take stuff. I mean, literally, you'd see them take chips, sodas, whatever. And we would be watched from the time we hit the door to the time we left. And so we'd watch our friends. They would steal and take stuff out, and they would watch us, you know, while all this was going on. So, yeah. You know, as you talk about privilege, it exists. It's there. And, you know, sometimes you just, I don't know, you don't want to acknowledge it, but it is there.
Yeah. I'm on a crusade to teach white people about white privilege. I'm telling you. Alan, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your story with us. John in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I have a story. I was living in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm sure you know where that is.
I do. I've been there.
And I was getting off of work. I took the bus. I had about a block to walk before I got home. It was maybe 8:30 or 9 at night. It was dark, not too much traffic. And I was walking down my street. I was about two houses away. A cop car was coming towards me, so we were going opposite directions. And as it passed me, I wasn't doing anything wrong, you know, I was just coming from work. As it passed me, I can hear the tires, you know, spinning around, turning around to make a U-turn. You just kind of can sense that. You could hear that noise of the tires. And sure enough, I was now almost right in front of my house on the sidewalk. And the cop pulled up really fast, got out of the car, and said, "Hey, can I talk to you?" Shined his light on me. And I said, "No." And I just kept walking. I was now like a step onto my front lawn. And he goes, "I just want to talk to you." I said, "Well, I don't have anything to say. This is my house. These are my keys, and I'm going inside." And I kept my keys out. He goes, "I just want to talk to you." And he goes, "What's your address?" And he shined the light on my mailbox, and I didn't even look at him. I just yelled it at him with my back to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I was obviously at my house. I knew my address. So I went inside. I locked the door, and the whole time he was saying, "I just want to talk to you." And I was just saying, "I don't want to talk to you." So I locked the door. I went inside. He stood outside the door and got on his radio. And about 5 minutes later, there was about, I would say, five or six more police in front of the house. And now they were walking into the backyard. Now, keep in mind, this happened probably 12 to 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a white guy. And I was living by myself, and I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? And you could hear them talking in the backyard. You could hear them talking in the front. You could hear their radios going. And so they were pounding on the door. "Sir, we just want to talk to you." And I went to the door, and I said, "I got nothing to say to you. I didn't do anything. I just was walking home from work from the bus stop."
Mm-hmm.
And they were out there, I would say, for 15 minutes, pretty much begging me to let them in. To talk to me. And slowly but surely, they drove away one by one, and I didn't let them.
Did you ever find out what was going on?
I didn't want to talk to them. No.
Yeah. Amazing.
I wasn't going to complain.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to complain, but, you know, I had to take that route every night home.
Yeah.
It's like.
Yeah, you don't want to make enemies.
For trouble if I do.
Yeah.
That. Yeah, I don't want to make enemies.
Amazing story. John, thanks for calling and sharing your story with us. Robert in Fort Worth, Texas. So you have a story to share?
Hey, Tom, yes, I do. First of all, I didn't know you were Buddhist.
Say that again?
Are you Buddhist?
Well, I don't know. Why do you ask?
Oh, because Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, I've chanted that many a time.
Oh.
And usually only one, you know, Buddhist will recognize it.
Yeah.
That's why I asked.
Yeah. I was into Buddhism for a while, and I did take refuge from the Dalai Lama. So you could argue that technically I'm a Buddhist, but most actual practicing Buddhists would ridicule that notion. So, but I'm very familiar with Buddhism, and Louise and I, you know, used to sit at the Soto Zen Center in Atlanta for every Sunday for years when we lived in Atlanta. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, excellent. Well, yes, I do have a couple of stories. Once, back in the day, this was back in the early 80s, I'd say about 82, 83, I was walking home, me and a friend of mine, from being out late one time. We lived in a group home at the time, and we were both stopped. And he was white, and now keep in mind, I'm half black and half Italian. And they pulled me off to the side and they go, "What's your name?" I told them my name. He said, "Where are you coming from?" I said, "Well, you know, we're just coming from down there. I think we were coming from the bowling alley or something at the time." "And where are you headed?" I said, "Well, we're headed back to the group home up here." No, "You stand right here for a minute." And another cop car pulls up and they're off to the side talking. They go, "You know, you look a lot like a guy who's been robbing a lot of houses in this neighborhood." I said, "Hey, whoa, wait a minute. Not me, man." I said, you said, I look like this guy. You have a poster or something? And he said, yeah, we do have a picture, as a matter of fact. Here, you take a look at this. And they show me this black and white poster with this guy's face on it, and the picture is so distorted. Well, I could look at it and say, I said, this guy looks nothing like me. Mm-hmm. And make a long story short, eventually they finally kicked us both loose. Now, here about 5 or 6 years ago, I wasn't living in Texas at the time. Now I live in Texas. Here about 5 or 6 years ago, my partner and I, his name is Tyrone, he's Irish, he's white. We were traveling to Corrales, New Mexico, to go visit my sister. Well, we're coming through Tucumcari, I'm driving, and I see this state trooper go by, and I saw the brake lights come on. I looked through the rearview mirror, I turned to my partner, and I said, I think we're fixing to get pulled over. He said, why? You weren't speeding. I said, I think we're fixing to, and before I could finish the sentence again,
yeah.
I put the turn signal on, and I ease it off to the right. They walk up to the side of the truck, and, you know, again, he approaches me. He goes, where are y'all headed? I said, up here to Corrales. We're going to go visit my sister. Why don't you climb on out of the truck here for me for a minute?
Yeah. So this was, Robert, we're hitting the brake here. So this was a driving while black stop. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, you've been racially profiled. Robert, thanks for sharing your stories with us. It's fascinating to hear other people's experiences like this. And I think, you know, once again, this emphasizes the need for us, A, to educate people about these issues, B, to educate our police, and C, to have higher standards for police and better pay.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need to be investing in our infrastructure, our policing infrastructure, and our education infrastructure first. That's a separate rant. We'll be back with more. And welcome back. Ronnie in New Haven, Connecticut, watching us on Free Speech TV. Ronnie, you got a story to share? Ronnie, you are on the air. You got to listen to your telephone, not your TV, because the TV has about a 60-second delay on it. Maybe it's, I don't know, 30, 40, something like that. Jeff in Murphy, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air, Jeff.
How are you doing today, Tom?
Good. How are you?
I love your show. It's the most refreshing thing I've ever seen.
Well, thank you.
I've got a different take on this white privilege than you do, though.
Okay.
On the other hand, I'm from a rather white, wealthy family just outside of Chicago. And I rejected that selfish, money-grubbing type lifestyle. I smoke a lot of pot. I like to hang out in the woods. I go hunting. I go fishing. Stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the major difference is the rich and poor. It's all about being poor. They will beat a poor black child just as quick as they'll beat a poor white child.
I don't disagree, Jeff, although we don't hear so many egregious stories out of rural West Virginia where you've got really severe poverty that's white. But there's a cycle here that I think particularly a lot of white people miss, and that is you have discrimination at the top of the circle. Discrimination then causes poverty, right? Poverty then causes crime. Crime then causes people to say, oh, look at that group, they're bad, right? They're criminal. And then, in other words, creates a rationale for discrimination, which then leads to the discrimination. And it's a vicious cycle. And the only way to break that cycle is to break one of those four nexus points, to either get, well, this is what Lyndon Johnson did, get people out of poverty by simply giving them money, which was the war on poverty, and it worked. And that breaks the cycle. Or end the discrimination, and, you know, we legally did that in the 60s. We still haven't actually done it. We have, you know, de jure, but not de facto. Another is to blow up the story that, hey, look at how all the crime that's happening in the black inner city, for example. Therefore, it must be there's a criminal class. You know, no, that's, you know, that story, that proves the danger of discrimination and racism. And
I get stopped in black neighborhoods just because I'm white.
Yeah, well, that was my story when I was 16. I got stopped in a black neighborhood because I was white.
On my rights.
And, well, I go ahead. I'm sorry.
I get thrown in jail quite often because I insist on my rights. I insist on a warrant. I insist on a reason to why they stopped me. I've taken several, you know, legal classes. I got my cousins are lawyers and bankers and everything else. You know?
You get thrown in jail?
Right. The most dramatic stories happened in, in Charlotte, North Carolina, when I was living there. Right. We got pulled over because we were four white guys going to my friend's grandma's house, her mother's house, who used to be his grandma's house. But it's in a black neighborhood now. It used to be an all-white neighborhood. Now it's all black. And she's the only white person living there. We got pulled over because we were four white people in a black neighborhood. They started bitching about drugs and demanded we get out of the car. And when I refused to be searched, they slammed me onto the ground, searched me. They found pot on me, threw me in jail. Next morning, they let me go free of charge. See you, you know, because it was an illegal stop. It was an illegal search.
Right. Fascinating. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. This, you know, again, it's, you know, hey, you're white in a black neighborhood. What are you doing here? We've got this bizarre mindset in this country about race. It's bizarre. 10 minutes before the hour, we'll be ready. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Rob Weissman is on the line with us. He's the president of Public Citizen. Citizen.org is the website. Hey, Rob, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. You guys are hosting a press conference in a couple of hours with senators over at the, it says Senate Swamp. What is the Senate Swamp?
Just a space right outside the Senate side of the Capitol.
Ah, okay. To talk about this constitutional.
It's actually something more insightful, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, who knows? In any case, it's to talk about this constitutional amendment that is going to be voted on today. Tell us about it.
Well, we're going to probably see the start of debate today. We may end up having a vote later on, but it's a vote on the Democracy is for All constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United, the 2010 decision that said corporations can spend whatever they want to influence elections. It would also overturn Buckley v. Valeo, the older decision that creates the idea that money equals speech.
Right. That's the original cancer right there.
That's right.
Lewis Powell's Buckley.
And the, you know, as you know very well, we desperately need the amendment. It's also an idea that seemed really fanciful here in Washington not so long ago, but there's been an enormous grassroots upsurge that's actually had an impact and hit the radar screen here. And as a result, the amendment went from 4 supporters in the Senate in 2010, 26 supporters by 2012, and now to the point where Harry Reid is going to bring it to a vote. We're going to get over 50 votes supporting the amendment, and we're going to not succeed in getting the thing enacted this year, to be sure, but we're going to take advantage of this really remarkable historic moment to create the energy and momentum we need to ultimately enact the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
That is great. It'll take 66 votes in the Senate, right? It had 2/3 majority of both the House and the Senate.
2/3 in the House and the Senate, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, which is going to be a bar that's probably unattainable, particularly given that Republicans love Citizens United and Buckley and First National Bank and the others that have followed on, McCutcheon and whatnot that have followed on from it. Because,
well, you know, just Republicans, the Republican congressional leadership loves it, and the Republican top donors love those decisions, but Republicans, regular people, actually don't. And when we look at, you know, there's all kinds of polling. We just conducted our own poll, which is bipartisan, done with a Republican and a Democratic pollster. Republicans hate the current campaign finance system almost as much, and sometimes even more than independents.
You mean Republican
and Democrats,
voters?
And they support remedies overwhelmingly. You know, we had like something like 38-35% support for a constitutional amendment among Republicans.
Right. So you mean Republican voters?
Republican voters, actual
right.
regular people.
Right. I've talked to a couple of Republican members of Congress over the years who have said, you know, I really hate the fact that I have to spend 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day raising money. It's demeaning. It prevents me from doing my job. And, you know, and I've said, well, why don't you publicly speak out about it? And the response has been that, well, to do that, I'd have to speak against my party. So, you know, I think that if this ever got a fair vote, we would all be astounded by the number of people who would come out for it. And it's the same reason why McCain-Feingold passed.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, and this, we face the same kind of problem, for example, in, you know, climate change issues where Republicans can't even acknowledge what they know to be true, which is that, we're facing this impending catastrophe. And I think what's going to happen, though, is we're going to breach the dam. So for right now, Mitch McConnell is able to exert enough control over his caucus. It's going to be very hard for us to break off any of the Republican senators, although we're still slightly hopeful. But that's not going to continue indefinitely. Eventually, the demand, which is going to keep growing, is going to be so much. And we're almost certain to face a large-scale scandal in the not-distant future. Those two things, I think, are going to end McConnell's lock on the Republican caucus, and we're going to get enough Republicans on board to actually get this thing passed to the Senate.
Interesting. Do you know something about this scandal, or are you just speculating?
No, I don't know anything, but I think it's a near. I think it's pretty much a certainty. I mean, there, as you know, and as basically everybody knows, there's
so
much money sloshing around right now. It's inevitable, you know. And of course, the biggest scandal is the system itself. But that said, with all this money sloshing around, it's just inevitable.
Oh, look at the investigation into Scott Walker right now.
What's that?
I said, look at the investigation into Scott Walker right now.
That's right.
I mean, this is all about the Koch brothers.
You know, and some of them are just stupid. Like, you know, the Scott Walker thing, it's kind of, why was he doing that stuff? It's just stupid. They can't help themselves. You look at what the Jack Abramoff scandal, where people were selling access and influence and maybe votes for really small amounts of money. It's just stupid. But when there's enough money around, they can't help themselves.
Right. Bob McDonald, for example, in Virginia. So, Rob, how come no end to corporate personhood?
Well, we're not going to be able to carry that on this one. I mean, we actually pushed for that pretty hard, we Public Citizen and many others, and we're going to continue to do that. This amendment doesn't include that. However, on the broad corporate personhood issues, however, it does have explicit language related to the campaign spending issue, which is this really a campaign spending?
Right. So you want to do this?
It does specifically give Congress and the states the power. It basically distinguishes between corporations and real live breathing human beings. So I think that the principle that corporations aren't people actually is carried forward in this amendment. The cure to the broad problem of that is not. I mean, and nor is this a cure to many other problems of corporate power. But it is a far-reaching amendment dealing with the issue of campaign spending.
Yeah, there you go. So everybody should contact their senators and say, vote for this thing.
Yeah. They should absolutely do that. It's possible we're going to get a vote tonight. We think actually now it's more likely there's going to be a start of a debate tonight. We'll get a vote later this week.
Right.
But we really need to – we've seen all of this energy and excitement and grassroots organizing around the country. Now people need to carry that forward and make sure their senators hear that message demanding a constitutional amendment right before they've got actually a chance to vote on it.
Right. And so you're dealing with this like, you know, the way that they ended slavery after the Civil War with three different amendments, 13, 14, 15, rather than one. And you're suggesting this should be two. I think it's a reasonable strategy. Citizen.org is the website. You can get all the information about it. Rob Weissman, the president of Public Citizen. Rob, thanks for dropping by today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Good talking to you. And we will be back. Doug Giles is going to drop by and explain to us the... how the left's true agenda is to destroy men. And then we will continue with your calls and stories. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And well, this is fascinating. Ah, there it is. Doug Giles is with us, the editor of ClashDaily.com, contributing columnist to TownHall.com, author of his latest book, Rise, Kill, and Eat, A Theology of Hunting from Genesis to Revelation. Previously, apparently, the author of Raising Boys Feminists Will Hate. Do I have that right, Doug?
Yeah, you're in the ballpark. How are
okay.
you doing, Tom?
Cool. Fine. Thanks for joining us today. So, the left's true agenda for males is the headline of your article. What is the left's real agenda for men?
Well, I don't know if I think the article on Clash Daily that AJ pitched to you guys was a video. I don't know if you had the ability to see it, but there's this chick that thinks eradicating the male population by 90% will heal the world. And back in 2012, I wrote a book called Raising Boys Feminists Will Hate. And I wrote in the opening salvo that feminists would love nothing more than to take your son and eradicate his masculine uniqueness. I don't think they like men. And as far as raising kids to be provider, protectors, hunters, and heroes, I think they're kind of leaning more towards a metrosexual Justin Bieber type anomaly instead of your classic masculine traits that used to be inherent within American culture. Right. But
So let me get this right, Doug. I want to understand this. About a third of Americans identify themselves as liberals. About a third of Americans identify themselves as conservatives. You're right. Saying that roughly a third of American women want to destroy all American men?
No, I'm not saying that at all, but I'm saying that there's great portions of society, and especially through academia and stuff, that think the male collective, those of us who live in a testosterone fog, are the problem with society.
Right.
And this girl's on steroids. I mean, Tom, if you and I, I know you come from a different political persuasion and stuff, but I think you and I would probably be in the eradication part of the process in regards to this chick.
Yeah, but this is like winning debates by anecdote. I mean, I could play a video of some guy from stormfront.org talking about how, some white guy about how all Catholics, Jews, and people of color need to be exterminated. That doesn't mean that all white guys think that. Just because one woman says something rather absurd, I'm astounded that you think that liberal women believe that. What do you have any evidence for that?
Empirical evidence? I don't have any that comes to mind real quick. All I know is that there's a constant war against men, and men who, again, like I said, they enjoy their masculinity. They think that there's nothing wrong with it.
How does it? What are the fronts in this war? Give me an example. Where's a battle in this war happening right now?
Well, again, I bring up this widespread interview where this Femithius, that's what she calls herself, right. Says that men are the problem. Men need to be eradicated. Men need to be systematically and selectively aborted.
Right.
So that we continually reduce the population to where guys are held on reservations,
right.
And they're just around for breeding.
So you've got one whack job woman. I mean, how can you say, and I quote, this is the left's true agenda for males?
Yeah, I don't know where you're quoting that from.
That's the headline of your article, the left's true agenda for males. I'm looking at it.
I have no idea. The article that it says this chick wants eradicating the male population by 90% to heal the world. That's what I'm looking at.
Oh, okay. Well, apparently,
You don't think that there's female chauvinism mm-hmm. against men that hails from the left, because it's not coming from center right.
I think that it's just certainly there's female chauvinism against men, just like there's male chauvinism against women.
Yeah.
But I don't
think
that
you don't think this, you
this
don't
is
think
an article of faith on the left.
You don't think that there's misandry in United States culture. And I'm telling you, bro, from a conservative standpoint, from a traditional standpoint, it ain't hailing, that kind of animus isn't hailing from the center-right crowd. It's coming from center-left and left-left.
Huh. Of abort all the male babies, or 90% of them.
Again, that's what this clown is saying. in her video and her interview with Vice, and it's disturbing.
But if that's your the basis of your argument, doesn't that make
overwhelming as it gets, man?
Yeah, but if quoting one clown and saying therefore, you know, 70 million people in America believe this, you know, and but without evidence, I mean, doesn't that make you the clown?
Again, this is a news source that popped up on our radar. We do news aggregation. We posted it, and you said you wanted to talk about it.
So right.
I'm here to talk about this chick that says this. And listen, I'll go off on any kind of rube, knuckle-dragging, conservative redneck that wants to extricate from the human collective somebody that, you know, doesn't drink the moonshine that he drinks.
So I'm curious, Doug, what should the appropriate roles of men and women be in our society in your mind?
Well, I've got two alpha male or alpha female daughters that both have owned their businesses since their late teens, early 20s, and one's closing on $1 million property in Austin. So
they castrated any men lately?
No, they haven't. They enjoy men. They want the guys to be men in the classic sense of the word.
What does that mean?
To be provider, protector, hunter, and hero instead of the guy who crawls up in the fetal position and wets his diaper and lives in his mother's.
Right. So if the guy is the provider, protector, hunter, and hero, does that make the woman the provided for, the protected, the user of what the hunter hunts, and the worshipful, you're the hero, acolyte, is that the word? Say what? Damsel in distress?
Not in your disparaging sense of the word, but you dredge up any of your female listeners that wouldn't want a male who, again, exhibits these kind of traits to be their husband. Do they want some pussy that can't get a job, that right. whines about how difficult life is, that acts more like a poodle than a bulldog? I mean, I don't know any women on this planet. We have millions of readers that rock up to Clash left, right, and center that's looking for some squishy, namby-pamby, hairy-back Mary to partner up with in marriage or in business to carry them or to walk with them through this thing called life. I don't know where any of these women exist that want that kind of cartoon of what I believe men are supposed to be. I don't know.
So women who are looking for a guy who is not strutting around with his open carry, who is not, you know, who may not earn as much as they do, which sounds like your daughters. Those women are not real women?
Sounds like my daughters.
Well, you said your daughters closed on $1 million deal. Is she making more than her husband?
I think they're about the same.
So doesn't that make her husband a namby-pamby? I mean, you know, do you have a problem?
Well, again, you know nothing about my family, know nothing about
my daughter. Brought it up. Forgive me. Yeah. We don't need to talk about your family. You're right.
Yeah, my daughter makes her cash because she's pretty famous. You go to Google her sometime.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah.
Well, good on her. Doug, we're running out of time here, so let me just, you know, plug your book and thank you. It's Doug Giles, the editor of ClashDaily.com, ClashDaily.com, contributing columnist at townhall.com. His latest book, Rise, Kill, and Eat, A Theology of Hunting from Genesis to Revelation, and the website, ClashDaily.com. Thanks, Doug.
Yeah, thanks, man.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I think, you know, we had been talking about racial roles and positions in the last hour. What about gender roles? And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. I think if you're describing anatomy, then, I think there's a difference. But anyway, context is everything. Jim, watching Free Speech TV in Concord, North Carolina, you called your senator about Citizens United?
Yeah, that's right, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. First of all, I've been listening to the stories, and I want to let you know that my wife and I are both doing whatever we can to point out where, as white people, we are privileged. to our conservative friends and our neighbors and whoever, and we get a bunch of strange looks, but I think a little bit of information might go a long way.
I agree.
All right. I called up Richard Burr's office this morning.
Republican senator from North Carolina.
Republican senator from North Carolina. And because we've been following what Bernie is doing, what you're doing, what your guest has been doing. And I said, I understand you got a important vote later on. And the staff member knew what I was talking about, and that was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, can you tell me how the senator plans to vote? And he said, well, he plans to vote against the amendment because he believes it violates the Bill of Rights. And I go, time out. The Bill of Rights, as far as I know, doesn't talk about rights of money, doesn't talk about rights of business, doesn't talk about rights of corporations. It talks about rights between you and me, a right of free speech.
Right.
So I don't see how it's violating the Bill of Rights. Well, I went on my Tom Hartman wannabe rap for about another 3-4 minutes, and the staffer just says, thank you very much. I'll pass the word along.
Yeah. It's amazing. Prior to 1976 in the United States, this is the Buckley versus Vallejo decision that Lewis Powell was so involved with. Prior to that, we always considered the spending of money for politics or any other purpose to be a behavior that could be regulated. And in fact, if you spend money on the wrong things, you know, prostitution, child pornography, drugs, you can go to jail for it, and or, you know, bribery or whatever. So spending of money has always been regulated as a behavior. And the Supreme Court in 76 said, no, it's not a behavior. It's actually a form of free speech. And I'm waiting for somebody to take a case to the Supreme Court where they say that, you know, when they bought that kilo of heroin, they were actually expressing their free speech opinion about how drugs should be decriminalized. You know, it's just that probably nobody who's in serious trouble is going to make a specious claim like that. It's a ridiculous claim. And yet that's the claim that that Richard Burr is hiding behind. That's the claim that the Koch brothers are hiding behind, that when they buy politicians, or when these politicians say, yes, you can buy me, that's not a behavior, that's actually speech. But, you know, if you're trying to buy something else, then, hey, that is a behavior. It's a bizarre logic, Jim. It's a bizarre logic. Good on you for calling Richard Burr's office, and thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Grand Island, New York. Hey, Jim, you're on the air.
How are you doing, Tom?
Good. You had a border control story. Is this the Canadian border?
Grand Island.
Is it
the Canadian border? Yeah, I live on Grand Island. It's a suburb of Buffalo.
Yeah.
I pull over the bridge, the Grand Island Bridge, and I see a white SUV pass me, all fancied out, tricked out. I look at it. The guy slams on his brakes, turns around in the middle of the bridge, and follows me down the parkway. I'm a 62-year-old white guy with 4 bicycles on the back of my minivan. He followed me for about a half hour, you know, until I got to my house, pulled into my driveway, and again, asked me for ID.
Now, your house and driveway, you are now in the United States, you're talking about. You just come across from Canada?
I was always in the United States.
Oh, I see.
Coming from Buffalo to Grand Island, New York.
Oh, okay.
Toll bridge on the New York State Thruway.
Right.
Well, he pulls in and he goes, well, I go, what's wrong? Or what did I do wrong? He goes, well, you eyeballed me on the bridge.
You eyeballed me?
I eyeballed him. So
now it's a crime to look at police?
I guess it is. And for the Border Patrol, So he asked me my citizenship. He was asking me all these stupid questions. You know, who's the president? All this other stuff. Like I said, I'm a 63-year-old.
Who's the president? These are the questions that back in the 60s, you know, you were supposed to ask somebody to find out if they were a deep cover Russian spy, right?
Yeah, I remember those days.
Amazing.
But, you know, anyway, a half hour later, my kids come out, and they're, you know, like, what's going on? And finally he goes, well, it really sucks because your license plate was obscured by the bike rack. And I go, since when is the Border Patrol in charge of traffic control?
Right.
And then he just, you know, went on to say, okay, I'm not going to give you a ticket now, but don't ride around with your bikes on the back of your van.
Amazing. Amazing. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing the story. That's amazing. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, you have a white privilege example?
Hi. Let me get you on speakerphone.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Tom?
Yeah. Still sounds like we're on speakerphone, but yeah.
Yeah, Tom? You were right about this white privilege thing. The Kent State, you know, Kent State, there were four students who were killed, arguably by accident, and that's like a mile marker of history. Whereas during the Civil Rights era, in like 67 or so, something like, or 68, there was a massacre at a black college in Mississippi where about 100 students were killed, or you know, 100 students and maybe some you know, professor or, you know, demonstrators were killed by the police. I think it was the state police anyway, and they were, you know, and you don't hear a thing about it.
I don't know about that. I think, Mark, your history might be wrong. Although there were a lot of black people killed during that era. And I mean, you go back to like the Symbionese Liberation Army where they, I think it was in Philadelphia, where they firebombed the apartment building from the roof and killed, you know, men, women and children. And maybe it wasn't SLA, but it was one of those, you know, smaller black power groups.
That was. I think you should really look it up because and that's how hard it is. That's how obscure it is in history.
Wow.
But, you know, it's not a secret and it's not even a controversial point. It's not, you know what I mean? It's, it is in fact something that happened but never gets talked about.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to track that down.
I invite you to look it up.
Yeah, I'm doing.
I'll try to look it up and I'll try to get you that, tell you, get you.
Do you know which state it happened in?
The story.
I would think, you know, massacre at black college would find it for you, but. Yeah, Shano's trying to Google the thing. Mark, we'll track it down. Thanks a lot for the call. Eddie in, say what? Jackson State? Really? Oh, when you get it, print it out and you know, we'll check it out. Eddie in Effort, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eddie.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I think you know my husband, Will, from Blakesley.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've met you a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm calling, I have a story about, actually, I do agree with your white privilege, but I think we all need to be a little fearful now, unfortunately.
Right.
As you know, we are very white. I'm 60. A couple weeks ago, we were at the Seaside Heights Boardwalk, and my 28-year-old white daughter and her very white boyfriend and my husband and I, my daughter was taking a home video of us on the boardwalk, and this guy comes up, this big burly guy, comes up to us and he wants to know if he's on the video, and he wanted to see the video. He's demanding to see it, and he's in our face and he's threatening her boyfriend and really being belligerent. So we just kind of like walk away from him because we didn't want to, you know, get into anything, you know.
Right.
It's not our style. And so we start walking away, and he says he's going to call the cops, and we say, go ahead, because we want to report you. You're very disturbing.
Huh.
We're walking back to our hotel room. Five cop cars surround us. This is in New Jersey.
Amazing.
Seaside Heights, where they want you to take pictures and post them. They want visitors.
Right.
Well, you know what? We'll never go back there. And Will is from New Jersey.
Was this guy a police officer or an undercover agent or something?
I think he thought he was an undercover agent. We found out later that he was an off-duty beach patrol guy.
Amazing. Eddie, thanks for the story. This is, you know, these last two stories are just examples of misuse of power. This is like, you know, hey, I didn't like the way you looked at me. And, you know, I don't want to be filmed. It's like, really? We really need to be holding our law enforcement to high standards and compensating them for it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I think we're fairly close to a national consensus. I mean, you've got, you know, even Rand Paul now talking about this stuff, that we need to reboot our police. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Hang on just a minute here. It's multiple computers all at once. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard.
Yes. Afternoon.
You have a story about the police killing a guy near you?
Yeah, this happened it was some time ago, Tom. Let me bring it up on my computer here. It happened on February the 9th of 2008. A gentleman stopped by where the county police had a person pulled over, and he stopped by the side of them, which got the curiosity of the police officer. Is, you know, why would you stop like that? So, and then he moved on. So the police were kind of curious as to, you know, why he did that. So they followed him, and they put their sirens and their lights on. And the gentleman, his name was Gary Dennison, he wouldn't pull over. He drove slowly, sort of like the O.J. Simpson chase. He wouldn't pull over. So they continued on for about a mile. He finally pulls down off of the road into the grass where he got stuck in the mud. And he couldn't go forward. He couldn't go back. They ordered him to shut his car off. And he refused orders. And so the one police officer jumped up on the hood of the car and shot him four times, point blank, right through the windshield.
Wow.
Yeah. This happened. It's still on the internet. But it's still on the internet. I'm surprised it's still there.
Yeah.
After that, all they said was that there was being an internal investigation, and they never released any information on it.
Yeah, it's nearly impossible in the United States to convict a police officer of killing someone wrongly. I mean, there are not only laws that stack against civilians who are killed by police or threatened by police, but there's also, you know, culture and history and all these other things. That's an amazing story, Howard. Thanks a lot for calling and sharing it with us. Michael in Silver Spring, Maryland, you wanted to respond to Doug Giles, who was saying that the liberal agenda is to abort all male fetuses. I guess they're 90% of them.
Yeah, I was on this late night talk show. It was on a black radio station. And we started talking about the feminization of black men, because I told you, Screener, that I was going to come from a black perspective.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Frances Quest Wilson had been listening. She's the writer of the book ISIS Papers. And she had been listening. And then, because we had talked about, if you pull it up, the marriage rate in 1960, I think it was like over 90% in the black community. So most kids had a father in the house. But it started to slowly go down, and around 1985 or 86, it got up to about 70, over 70% woman-headed household. And I know you're going to get calls from black women and black men saying I'm crazy.
Well, no, Michael, what I'll tell you is that the same thing happened in white communities as well. That, you know, I don't know that your numbers are right, but we have seen an increase in white women who are single mothers, just like we have seen an increase in black women who are single mothers since the 60s. And,
yes,
you know, and many people, there are people who are saying, so what? You know, it doesn't mean that you're a bad parent. Barack Obama turned out okay. He was raised by a single mother. And then there are also people who are saying this was the result of of women moving into the workforce, which is something that happened, started happening aggressively in the 1960s. Prior to that, women were not in the workforce. And as women started moving into the workforce, they became sufficiently independent. They didn't need to depend on men. And, you know, is this a the question is that a bad thing or a good thing? I think, you know, everybody thinks that this ideal family, this Leave It to Beaver family of dad and mom and you know, 2.3 children in the home and all this kind of stuff is some sort of mythical standard. But I'm not sure that's ever been really established.
And see, my point was that if what's happened, it's not when I use the term feminization of the black man, it's you know, in the street, they will beat you down. They rough and tough in the street. But as soon as they get home, because they've only seen a woman in an authoritative position, it's like automatic. It's incredible. And the sons are raised not, they can't, you remember when you were little, you used to eat dirt, you used to fall down, you get holes in your pants. You know, you didn't care about if somebody stepped on your foot. You wouldn't be ready to go to into a fight like in the black community. If you step on somebody's tennis shoes, it's going to be it's like pushing a button where it's going to be incredible. But the kids can't cut grass. They can't hold. They don't know how to use tools or anything, a shovel. You know, things that your father would have taught you. Right. And it's incredible how in the black community, that's the only community that I can speak for. And even Tim Wise has said the same thing that you've said about the rates of marriage have gone down in the white community. But I can only speak for the black community and being a football coach where, you know, you got a 6'4", 240 pound guy that's you gotta work so hard to try to bring out that masculine part of them, and even taking showers where we walked around in our locker rooms. I know you did. You didn't care, but I mean, all of a sudden, you know, all the black kids, because I coached in a black high school, they don't take showers after football practice, and it's just like
why not?
All the football coaches would be like, what the hell is going on? And it seems like the only thing was that they're raised in an environment where they've only seen a woman in an authoritative, from school to home, right, in an authoritative position. And when they get older, you know, they don't,
is your concern, Michael, or argument that therefore, African-American men are more likely to be deferential to the women, that they say, okay, dear, whatever you want? Or is your argument that they are more likely to be abusive because they're pushing back against authority figures?
No. It's more of a yes, dear. As soon as, it's like I said, outside the door of their home or the apartment, I mean, if anything,
tough guy.
They're going to be tough.
Yeah.
But as soon as they walk into their home environment, it's like there's, not like our fathers. Our fathers, you know, were principled men. You know, my dad didn't hardly, we hardly ever saw my dad laugh because everything was serious to him because of what he was facing in the workplace, you know, having, you know, being in the 60s and the 50s and everything. He couldn't, he had to look out for us.
But isn't it, Michael, better to be deferential to the women in your life than to beat the crap out of them?
No, but I've never seen my father cuss my mother. I've never seen them argue. I've never seen my parents drunk. He was a good and principled man.
Right.
But when I go and look at today's, ever since the 80s, that's all I can talk about is what I've seen from the transition from the 80s is a feminization of black men, you know, growing up where they don't wear the pants in the family no more. And then when they move into an environment where they are married, it's yes, dear, yes, dear, yes, dear. You know, it's not like our fathers. Like my father says, you don't let a woman, you know, control the finances of your home, you know. And it's, you know, just that mentality of when, I guess, from Adam and Eve or Lucy to 1960s.
Well, here's, Michael, in the 1960s, women could not get credit cards. You know, a single woman could not get a credit card. She had to get it through her husband. It wasn't until 1974 that we actually passed a law to change that. They couldn't serve on juries in most states. They couldn't get access to the birth control pill. The Ivy League schools, the best schools in the country, all denied women access. It wasn't until 1981, for example, at Columbia even started admitting women. And they got roughly half of what men got in the workplace. There was no equality in the workplace. So how can we say that that was an idealized time? I mean, women were, you know, you talk about white privilege, male privilege was really big back then. I mean, could it be that this feminization of men that you're talking about is a good thing?
What about the masculinization of women? I mean, we have our roles in our family. You know, there's a role that you have to. Like, I never seen my mother cut grass. It was always me and my brother.
Yeah. No, I got it, Michael. I got it. Thank you for the call. We'll see what our callers have to say.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
My take on it is that, some of us may be looking for a distant time that really wasn't all that good. It's really not worthy of replicating. Welcome back. Josh in Algona, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was reading the Star Tribune this weekend, and I found a couple interesting articles. First one said the feds investigate local terrorist pipeline to Syria. And what I found is that, you know, the Obama administration and the FBI have been on this since the beginning of the summer, if not earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting, you know, because the conservatives constantly say, well, he's been on knowing this for a year, nothing's been done. Well, that's just not true.
Yeah.
And then secondly, also in the same paper, and you tell me what you think about this, Tom, and this was a good point that I really hadn't thought about. And I'm just going to quote the paper directly. It goes, the relatively moderate rebel factions are in tatters. There are no secular groups, and the strongest factions are Islamic groups, many working with Al-Qaeda's branch in Syria,
right.
Nusra Front. And right. So, I mean, can we blame the president for being cautious and arming these people? And
no, I think it's really smart. Did you see the piece in the New York Times today about how Kuwaiti princes, or maybe it was the UAE, was in Qatar, that these princes are going on television. They're doing it in Saudi Arabia as well, raising money for the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria.
Right, right. I mean, so my question to you, Tom, is this. We don't want American boots on the ground, but ISIS, for anywhere from Elizabeth Warren to Dianne Feinstein, all say they need to go.
Right.
How do we go about this?
You empower the local moderate Sunnis, and you have to understand the genesis of this. When we took down Saddam Hussein in the spring of 2003, the first thing that L. Paul Bremer did was his famous debathification. He went in and he fired the entire army, all the police forces, and about half of all industry in the country was owned by the Ba'ath Party and run by the government or government employees. He fired all of them and basically shut down the country. And these were a lot of these people were Sunnis, including some of the, you know, generals in the army and whatnot. And he said, you will never be hired again, period. So it's been, what, 10 years, 11 years now since then. And these guys have, you know, you get men with guns without a job and with systematic discrimination against them. And then when we finally got out of Iraq, we left behind a Shiite government, you know, al-Maliki, who was aligned with Iran and who had purged all the Sunnis from his government. So now you've got all these unemployed Sunnis in Iraq, which is about half Sunni, all these unemployed Sunnis who are going, we're being screwed. These people are, you know, and these people, Sunnis and Shia, have been fighting each other for 700 years. So they're saying we're being screwed. So, you know, the Sunnis in and the same thing's happening in Syria. You've got a government there. You know, the Bashar al-Assad's government is Alawite, is Shia. And the Sunnis are feeling repressed. Or oppressed, so they say, okay, we're going to fight against Assad and we're going to fight against Maliki. And, you know, the basis of this is sectarianism. It's our religion versus their religion, or our sect of Islam versus their sect of Islam. And, I, you know, it's almost become a kind of a racial thing, but it's like this is a problem that was created by George W. Bush and the policies of the Bush administration. It was absolutely predictable. It was predicted by lots and lots of people. And the only way that we're going to, quote, solve this is to start backing out of this region, demilitarize this region, get the Kuwaitis and the Qataris and the Saudis to quit funding these people. John McCain and Lindsey Graham went over to Saudi Arabia and got Prince Bandar to give what became ISIS a whole bunch of weapons and money. I mean, this is a real problem. We've got to back away from it. Josh, thanks a lot for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Harbin program. Let's check in with Victoria Jones over at the White House with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on? I see from my TV monitor here that, is that Josh Ernst doing a press conference right now?
Yes, indeed.
Right, yes. Above your head?
Yes, he's right above my head. I've ducked out, and I will duck back.
Aha. Okay, so... between the ducks, what have you learned?
Well, what I've learned is, as you know, the Obama administration is preparing to carry out a campaign against ISIS, and President Obama will give a speech to the nation about this at some point on Wednesday. We're not told when. We're not told the context of the speech or anything about that. In fact, the first question at the briefing from the Associated Press was about it, and he said, well, I'm not going to get ahead of the speech. So you pretty much know that everything that he says about that is going to be irrelevant because he's not going to answer it. He's not going to answer your questions. We know that it's a three-point campaign. At least that's what we understand from the New York Times. The first phase has started. That's the air campaign. The next phase is an intensified effort to train and equip and advise the Iraqi military, Kurdish fighters, and possibly members of Sunni tribes. And then the final phase is to destroy ISIS in its sanctuary inside Syria. And that's the phase that seems to be murkiest, about which we know the least. We do know that they were able to put together a coalition of the United States and nine other countries at the NATO summit in Wales last week. And Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is in Turkey today for talks. Turkey is very worried about ISIS, which has kidnapped 49 of its diplomats, including children.
Whoa.
Yes. Oh, yes, took them a while ago, a couple of months ago.
Is Turkey a mostly Sunni or Shiite Muslim state?
Mostly Sunni. It's considered fairly secular. It does have a religious government. There's a lot of pushback between a fairly secular populace and a fairly religious ruling political party. You know, it banned Twitter. Massive pushback. Things like that. Had to let Twitter back in again. So Secretary of State John Kerry's in the Middle East. He's trying to get a whole bunch of Middle Eastern countries together. And the Arab League came out, the head of the Arab League came out over the weekend saying that its members need to confront ISIS militarily and politically.
Wow.
On the human rights front, the new UN human rights chief, Jordan's Zayd Ra'ad Al Hussein, who's the first Muslim to hold the position, urged world powers today to protect women and minorities targeted by ISIS in Iraq and Syria. He said that the fighters were trying to create a house of blood. He described the Islamic State in his maiden speech to the council as Takfiris, hardline Sunni militants who justify killing others by branding them apostates. He said they reveal only what a Takfiri state would look like should this movement actually try to govern in the future. Mm-hmm. And he said, in the Takfiri mind, as we have seen in Nigeria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Kenya, Somalia, Mali, Libya, Syria, and Iraq, there is no love of neighbor, only annihilation to those Muslims. Christians, Jews, and others, all together, the rest of humanity who believes differently to them.
Wow, that's a very eloquent statement.
Yeah, so this is pretty major stuff. The new Veterans Affairs Secretary, Bob McDonald, today rolled out a three-pronged strategy to revamp the troubled department. The plan's called the Road to Veterans Day, and it's designed to rebuild trust with veterans, improve healthcare delivery, and, quote, set a course for long-term excellence, McDonald said in his first press conference as VA chief.
Wow. He doesn't have to every 10 minutes say, no, I'm not promoting vitamins.
No, he doesn't have to do that.
All right, good, good.
Doesn't have to do that. He also said, I want to personally apologize to all veterans who experienced unacceptable delays in care in Phoenix and across the country. As an example of just how messed up the department is, he wants to flatten the organization and use more digital technology. He noted the department has 14 websites that each require a separate login and password to access. That's just flat wrong, he said.
Yeah, he's right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, said today that the NFL should impose a tougher penalty on Ray Rice for punching his then fiance in an Atlantic City elevator earlier this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I've brought this up and I've had conservatives call up and say, yeah, but then she went on to marry him. So why are you trying to stick your nose in his business?
Well, he said the video released today emphasizes how egregiously weak and wrong the initial penalty was,
right.
And it constitutes new powerful evidence that requires the commissioner to reconsider and reach a stronger punishment.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree.
And he was joined by Senators Tammy Baldwin and Chris Murphy.
Yeah, good, good.
So we've got that. Also, today, a big day today for new secretaries. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell today called for an end to the strident partisan debates over Obamacare that have dominated U.S. politics for 4 years.
Yeah, Obamacare is now working. I mean, you know, the next year's premiums are going to be lower. You've got a couple of Republican-controlled states that are saying, well, maybe we'll take Medicaid expansion.
And in fact, that was one of the things that she suggested. She pushed more Republican governors to do that.
Right. But then you've got, you know, I mean, look at Virginia. Terry McAuliffe tried to work out a deal with the Republicans. There's about 400,000 people eligible for Medicaid in that state who would get health care. These are working poor people. And the Republicans said, nah, most you can cover is 50,000.
It's a pretty intransigent legislature.
And party. I would say, you know, it's just they're clinging to this, as to paraphrase the president in an earlier year, they're clinging to this notion. Anyhow, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's always nice talking.
Thank you.
We'll be back. Be your credit card, and does that mean we've got a whole brand new stealing your phone problem?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Quick heads up, on Friday of this week, I will be speaking at the Yes Magazine's fourth annual celebration, September 12th, 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall in Seattle. And if you would like to attend, get thee over to Yes Magazine, YESmagazine.org, and sign up. It'll be a lot of fun. Money, politics, and saving our democracy. So I believe Dan Sisson is going to be there also. Dan and I have a book coming out this fall. In fact, we may have books there. I believe that we're going to have books there for sale. The new book is called The American Revolution of 1800, How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction and What This Means Today. And Dan is a noted historian. So just a heads up that that's coming at the end of this week, Friday this week. A couple other things I wanted to share with you, just to, you know, put them in the hopper, bring you up to date, fill you in. Number one, and I find this fascinating, and I'm curious how, you know, your thoughts on how we should react to this, what we should do. The number one crime here in Washington, D.C., the most common crime, is stealing iPhones. And, you know, I'm sure there's large crime categories that beat this. But, you know, it's, if you look at these little, you know, individual things, is stealing phones, stealing people's smartphones. Not just iPhones, but all kinds of smartphones. And, you know, you're down in the subway, you're in the metro, you're standing on the street, whatever, and you're talking on your phone or you're looking at your phone or you're texting or something, and somebody just comes running by and goes, grab and zoom, and there goes your phone. Now, there's a concern here in D.C., and I don't know to what extent this is happening all around the country, but just over the border in, I think it's Virginia, there is a mall over in the Pentagon direction. There's this shopping center this mall where there's a machine and you drop a smartphone into it and $200 in cash comes out. And there have been efforts to get rid of this. I don't know if they've been successful or not. It's been a while since I've seen a story about it in the local press. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that smartphones are highly saleable. Louise had the experience of leaving her phone in a cab in New York. And, you know, we tried to cancel everything on it, but this was before there was any kind of Find My Phone stuff, and there's no kill switch, you know, yet. And apparently her phone, apparently this is the fate of a lot of them. It ended up in Southeast Asia, excuse me, in Central Asia, in the Middle East, and or North Africa, in one of those countries, and somebody had bought it. And they found all of Louise's data on it, and they tried to log into her accounts and were actually successful in some cases because the apps automatically logged in. And it was like, whoa, talk about a wake-up. So, you know, right now somebody will snatch your phone for the $200. Well, the new iPhone, which they're going to be announcing tomorrow, apparently has a chip and an antenna in it that allows you to load your credit cards into it, and then in stores that are equipped for it, when you're checking out, and people do this with their credit cards in Europe. I've been there, I've seen it, where you just kind of wave your credit card in the vicinity of the cash register, and boom, all that information is transmitted. Because the cards are chipped. Well, this is going to do the same thing with your phone, or even more. Your phone actually sends out radio waves saying, here's my credit card number. Now, if you're standing in the subway holding your phone, you're holding something that's like, hey, $200, and if you really dig hard, you might get more, but it's $200. On the other hand, once that phone becomes all your credit cards as well, you're not standing there holding $200. You're holding whatever your line of credit is. It might be $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. I mean, who knows? Somebody snatches that thing. Would you stand out in a public area with your credit card in your hand, just kind of waving it around and expecting it for somebody to snatch and run with? So it's going to be interesting to see what the security features are going to be on this. And I'm assuming that you have to put in a PIN every time you use it, all that kind of thing, and how hackable and crackable that is. And, you know, it's just a whole bunch of things. So, and I'm curious your thoughts and response to that. Okay, number one. Number two, a Pennsylvania court has sentenced Jennifer Ann Whalen to prison. up to a year and a half in prison last week. Her 16-year-old daughter got pregnant, did not want the pregnancy, did not want the baby. And it was early enough in the pregnancy that it could easily be aborted. And so she bought this drug cocktail, misoprostol and mifepristone, that are commonly used in the United States to induce abortions. And she bought this from an online pharmacy, an overseas online pharmacy. They shipped them to her. She gave them to her daughter. Her daughter had a miscarriage. I mean, that's what it does, is it produces a miscarriage very early on. And, you know, it was like a really severe menstrual period. And her daughter was in so much pain from this, which is not uncommon with this kind of drug combination, so much pain that she went to the hospital. And once she got to the hospital, the story came out. The hospital notified authorities. The authorities arrested mom. The law in Pennsylvania says abortions can only be done by doctors, not by mom handing you some pills. And so mom is going to go to prison. And when mom was asked, you know, why didn't you just take her to an abortion clinic, her answer was, there aren't any nearby. And, you know, all these Republican laws and whatnot have made it really, really hard to get a 16-year-old an abortion. This is bizarre. I mean, this is a crime against humanity. It's certainly a crime against women. This Republican war on women all across the country, on women's reproductive rights, there has to be a man inserted in the decision. A judge, a police officer. This is just wrong. Meanwhile, Scotland might hold a referendum on whether to leave the United Kingdom, as Paul Krugman writes over at the New York Times in today's opinion pages. It's titled Scots, What the Heck? And Krugman makes a really, really good point. And that is that if you want to be a sovereign country, you damn well better control your currency. Because otherwise you get backed into a corner and you get screwed. This is what's happened to Greece. It's what's happened to Spain. It's what's happened to Portugal. It's what, you know, right across the board, these EU countries that are only using the euro, they no longer control their own currency. Greece no longer has the drachma. And so they can't just, you know, devalue their currency when they get, you know, when a recession happens. They can't stimulate their economy when a recession happens. And as a consequence, they're being decimated. Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal, they're going through a worse depression right now than they did in the 1930s. And if Scotland separates from the UK and fails to come up with their own currency, and they have been part of the UK for over 300 years now, so since King James I, this is going to be a tough one. But if they fail to come up with their own currency, they're going to be in the same position Greece and Spain are in. And Krugman is absolutely right about this. And this is not only an argument for, you know, Krugman is positioning it as an argument against separation from England. They have said, if we become separate, we're going to use the British pound. Instead, what they should be saying is, we want to separate from the UK and we want to create a Scottish currency. And similarly, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Greece, these countries in Europe should be going back. You know, Spain should go back to the peso. Greece should go back to the drachma. Portugal should go back to the real, I think it was. They should just be saying enough. But they're not. So Germany is getting rich and they're getting poor. And in this case, Krugman is absolutely right. If Scotland separates, they'll just get screwed by the UK.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Not a good thing. So anyhow, there's a few other things in the news I'll share with you after the break, and we'll pick up your calls. Stick around. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Norma, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, welcome to the program. You have a white privilege story?
Yes, I do. First, there's two. First, in 1972, my husband drove my car to work and sold it. I no longer owned a car. He could legally do this in Alabama.
Wow.
But secondly, about 25 years ago, I hired some black guys to build me a barn.
You're white.
Yes, I'm white. They had never worked with a white woman before, and so they were a little scared. But we managed to build a 12-stall barn. It took us about 2 years to do this, working on Saturdays and Sundays, because all of us had regular Monday to Friday jobs. About the second year into it, the men in the neighborhood came and complained to me because I was ruining the local economy because I paid the black men too much money.
What?
When, yes. And then...
How did he know what you paid them?
Because they refused to work at the old pay scale that they were being paid by the white men.
Oh.
And I paid better.
Oh.
But it was hard work building a barn from scratch.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And we were working from can-see to can't-see, if you know what that means.
I don't.
And
I'm sorry, but I...
That means from when the light, there's enough light to see what you're doing until the sun goes down.
Oh, from can-see. I got it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then when I was, and working for the state, we hire from a register. And the top 20 people were black. I hired a black guy from Jacksonville, Florida, to work with me at night in the computer room. My boss thanked me for hiring, said it would help the demographic report for the department. And he said, but aren't you worried about getting raped? I was 45. The kid was 20. I said, he's not going to rape me. He's moving from Florida to take this job.
Jeez.
And then when I hired the second one, I got cussed out and said, you really like him, don't you?
You're kidding.
I am not kidding.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And today, these black guys still work for me when I need them.
That's great.
I can trust them. They bring their wives, and we sit around and talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, my neighbors say, why do you have so many black people at your house? They're my friends. You have black friends?
Your neighbors need a wake-up call there, Norma. They're actually blessed to have you in the neighborhood. Norma, thanks a lot for the call. James in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, James, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Well, I was going to talk about potholes, but, man, it sounds like all the phone calls coming in sound like people dealing with predatory issues.
Yeah.
The way I see it, get rid of the dirty energies and the power that comes with it, just start moving forward. I think we start shaking a lot of that mindset loose. And iPhones, I think iris technology would help a lot with the security on those phones.
Iris technology?
Yes, sir. Iris scan technology. I know it's
oh, iris scan. Security. Oh, I you know, scan your iris, the inside of your eye, the outside of your eye, actually, the iris, yeah. Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing that with thumbprints. The new iPhones have a thumbprint security thing, and only your thumb can unlock the phone.
Yeah, well, your thumb could be removed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Or your thumbprint can be faked. You know, we've all seen that done in the movies. James, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And we'll be right back with more in just a second. It's 20 minutes past. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. You wanted to talk about this abortion story, this woman who got an abortion for her daughter and now is looking at prison?
Well, it wasn't so much that I want to harp about that story so much as just key off of what you were saying. What she was saying was like, you know, that whole thing. I mean, if hospitals are going to turn families into the law when they're just trying to do what's best for their kids, that's a bad deal right there. And as far as the country needing a wake-up call in terms of the bigotry and prejudice that's so, you know, widespread, I think that's true. I don't know how that's going to happen. How is the general population going to receive any kind of wake-up call from progressive media when it's so self-censored? I just don't see how that's going to happen when they're allowed to just keep talking their lies and spouting their bigoted racist point of view and such control. And
hey, Bob, that bigoted racist point of view gets Republicans elected over and over and over again, particularly in the South.
Well, I'm not for that.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, I'm not for the racists and the bigots being elected over and over again. I think we need a wake-up call across this country. I don't know how it's going to happen until people get down to the nuts and bolts of the issues.
Yeah.
It's the economy rests on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're destroying our natural environment and we're throwing people in jail for talking about, even talking about a change in energy policy, we have got a serious fascisto problem here.
Yeah, I'm with you. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Tim, in Annandale, Minnesota, you're on the air. And thanks for listening to 950 AM. What's up, Tim?
Yeah, well, kind of swinging you back to talking about white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
I am a white guy, but I kind of had a little view into the situation back in the early 70s, the late 60s, because I was a bit of a hippie and had hair down to my butt and the whole deal. And we got profiled, the group of people I hung out with, and traveled from Minnesota down to New Orleans in early winter, like February of 1970. And we were pretty much the white-black kids. And the only the major difference of that whole thing is all I needed to do was cut my hair and put on some clothes without holes in it, and I was back to good to go.
Yeah.
But yeah. I definitely saw the hatred, you know, and in a lot of cases it was absolutely hatred, and we were the problem, and we got pulled over because of what we looked like.
Yeah, there were real culture wars going on in the late 60s, and I agree. From 67 to 69, I think I had hair down to the over my shoulders anyway, and I know what you're talking about, but it still was always shrouded with white privilege. You know, we were treated, even the despicable, dirty hippies were treated better than people of color.
Well, and for instance, I did get in an argument with a cop in St. Paul back in, I don't know, back in 69. He pulled me over, and I had a bag of weed sitting on my front seat,
Yeah. Which
can kind of tell you something about me. I didn't even hide it. But he took it, and he said, I'm going to be a nice guy. I'm going to let you go.
Right. And
just go home and don't come back out the rest of the day. And I said, so you're going to keep that? And he goes, well, yeah. And I argued with him. I was like, oh, that's not cool, man. You're going to take that and smoke it.
I want my weed.
And I did that for a bit. And then finally it dawned on me, yeah, idiot, he's letting you go.
Right.
And
right.
I finally got to, yes, sir, thank you, sir, and drove away. But
yeah.
That's the difference. That's white privilege right there. Because
yeah.
I guarantee you, no black dudes that I knew were arguing with the cops about, let me keep my weed.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Tim, thanks for the call. Rudy in Riverside, Illinois. Hey, Rudy.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've got an incident about the police, early 70s in Chicago. Driving on the north side of Chicago, a car comes behind me with a red light and a siren, unmarked car. I don't know who it is. And I went a while because a lot of phony police stuff was going on. People that weren't police were stopping people. But after a while, I pulled over to the curb. I got out of the car, and these guys were in plain clothes, about four of them. And I asked them why they were stopping me and who they were. I said, I want to see some identification. One guy got real tough, looked like he wanted to fight. But there was a sensible person that seemed to be the leader. And he says, well, wait, we'll show you our identification. Then they looked at my driver's license, and I'm a white European ethnicity. And they told me, actually, the leader of the groups told this guy just to calm down, and I had a right to see his identification. So anyway, they said they were looking for someone, and I looked like the person they were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite an experience, and it's not only minorities getting pulled over. You know,
so you didn't get beaten up, you didn't get shot, you didn't get thrown in jail for a couple of days.
No, absolutely not. But I tell you something, if that tough guy would have tried something, I might have got into it with him. So, if there wasn't, in fact, I would suggest that police that operate in groups of two or three or four have at least one sensible person in their group.
Yeah. So are you saying you would have gotten into a fight with a police officer, Rudy?
Who, me?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
Did you say you would have gotten in a fight with a tough guy cop?
Because I didn't. That was before I saw their ID.
I see. Okay, Rudy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I was going to say, that's white privilege on steroids. We will be back 28 minutes past it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This over at BuzzFeed.com. Three scientists who were studying bats in a cave near the U.S.-Mexico border in southern Arizona were confronted by heavily armed militiamen who mistook them for illegal border crossers or smugglers. We now have, border patrol agents and sheriff's departments saying, we don't want these vigilantes down here. They're going to hurt somebody. They're going to get hurt themselves. This is just not right. Amazing. It's just amazing. But they're down there because, there's brown people crossing that border. We got to do something about this. Albert in Brick, New Jersey. Hey, Albert, you wanted to talk about that Seaside, New Jersey case?
Yes, Tom. The Seaside police, if you look up the court records, you can find out that they have had civil suits against them in federal court for civil rights violations, and I believe they had to pay a few people over the years settlements of thousands of dollars. I don't have a computer or a smartphone with me, so I can't look up and tell you the names of the people in the case or exactly who the lawyers were or anything, but they definitely had to pay money because of civil suits in federal court. So they do have a history of civil rights violations of people, it's been documented. So, if you can look it up. So, they have a history of that kind of thing. I tend to believe what the woman said.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. I mean, it's also not unique to the Seaside, New Jersey Police Department. But Albert, thanks for the call. Excellent point. By the way, breaking news, Ray Rice, the Ravens just terminated his contract. Ray Rice, the guy who punched out his then fiance in a hotel elevator, punched her hard enough that when the elevator hit the ground floor and the security camera caught them walking out, she was down. She was on the ground. And now, today, the video, or maybe it was yesterday, the video of him punching her in the elevator from the elevator security camera has come out. And it looks really nasty. And so, it's are we as a society, on the one hand, starting to take seriously things like violence against women and pushing back and saying, no, this is not acceptable? Or are we, as Doug Giles said in the previous hour, having genocide by man-haters? Is the left's true agenda to get rid of all the men? And, I don't know what Doug would say about this case, but, there are those who would say, oh, yeah, the man's the victim. Really? David in Silver Springs, Florida. Hey, David, thanks for calling in. What's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I listen to you all the time. And every once in a while, I get the inclination to call because you hit on something that I'm familiar with. When I was about 15 or 16, on Miami Beach, there were four of us sitting at a bus bench at night waiting for a bus. Police came by and stopped. And what are we doing there? Not in a nice way, just like police can do when they want.
Right.
This was back in the 50s. It isn't something that's happened recently, but it started back then, and there's nothing been able to stop the police from getting worse. Miami Beach has got a terrible reputation for police taking advantage of people.
Yeah.
Anyway, this cop told us, if you're out of here, not out of here, by the time I come back again, I'm going to run you all in. We were kids. I didn't care then.
Wow.
It didn't impress me. So I just sat there and waited for the bus.
Yeah.
But it's happened for a long time.
Huh. Yeah, this is, I mean, you know, there are some people, you give them a gun and you tell them that at a certain level you are above the law. Now, theoretically, they're not at all, but the reality, fact of the matter is that the police have many, many opportunities to be above the law, to ignore the law. You know, whether it's running a red light to get to the donut shop, which literally happened recently. There was a case where a couple of different police cars were running red lights, and, you know, an alert citizen spotted it and followed one of them, and they all converged on a donut shop. You know, I'm not just, you know, propagating an old horrible stereotype. This is actually what happened. You know, from that to, you know, shooting Michael Brown. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of stuff that you know, it's very, very difficult to do anything about when the police ignore the law. David, thanks for the call. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, hi, Tom. So much to talk about. Hey, I want to just put in something that's going to be controversial. I'm going to jump to the main topic, though.
Okay.
Beyonce's sister got in a fight with Jay-Z. Everybody wanted to know what she said to provoke him. Nobody's asking what this lady said to provoke this guy. But skipping that, love you, ladies. The Alabama lady showed the power of woman. They was asking her why she was hiring black men. She was sensitive enough to know that, you know, you keep people happy. Woman, that's the woman's power, being sensitive. And they could start World War III if they want. Until the ladies realize how to use that power, we guys really need it. Okay, jumping to the subject of white privilege and racial profiling. I think they both are the side of the same coin.
Yep.
You look at the NYPD shutting down the Occupy movement, and look how Wall Street gave a big donation to them for doing that.
Yep.
It gives you an idea. We focusing on bad cops. We need to focus on who gives them the marching orders. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll listen to your response.
Well, thank you, Jesse. I think you said it all. I think that was very, very spot on. And Jamie Dimon and Citibank, well, I believe it was. That's his bank, right, Citibank? I mix up the big banks. Jamie Dimon, I believe it was him, gave $4.5 million, as I recall, to the Benevolent Police Association, the police union, or one of the funds associated with it in New York City, either just before or just after they broke up Occupy New York or Occupy Wall Street. And it's something that's dropped into the memory hole, and you just brought it out, Jesse. Thank you. Good talking with you. Davis in Radford, Virginia. Hey, Davis.
Yeah. Yes. Hi, Tom. See, I've noticed that the Republican Party has been using these racist code words to describe people who are using welfare or food stamps, like they'll call them undeserving or lazy.
Right.
And I've also noticed that the Koch brothers are sponsoring these resegregation laws where they're making it legal now for schools not to allow colored students to get into certain schools.
How so? I'm unfamiliar with that, Davis. How so? How does that work?
What it works is they pass laws down there where it's kind of similar to a corporation being a person, or say money being free speech. Well, now down there they can say this school doesn't allow this black person in the school, but they don't really have to say why they do it, and you can't. And so they're watering down the laws on the
are you talking about the school choice and charter school thing and the way that schools basically self-select for good students versus bad students, that they're self-selecting using race as a criteria?
Right. It makes it harder for a person of color to prove the point, or even have people look at it.
Yeah. Interesting. Davis, thanks for sharing. Thanks for the call. Valerie in Bennington, Vermont. You have a...
Hey, how are you, Tom? I met you in Northampton a while back.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Great.
Yeah, during your book signing.
Yeah.
I have a story.
Uh-huh.
When I moved to where I'm presently located, the name of the hill is, I'm going to use a hypothetical name, it's Smith Hill Road.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have a Smith Road. Well, when we got 911, the cops, well, we got 911. So anyway, I fell asleep on my couch one night, and about 3 in the morning, the cops come pounding down my door. And I said, what are you doing here? They said, you called us. What's the problem? I said, I didn't call you. And they said, you know, there's a problem. You called us. We have a phone call from you for 911. I said, I didn't call. So anyway, he threatened me with the possibilities and the results of if I had filed a false report and the penalties that I'm going to incur. And I said, listen, you better call your dispatcher up right now because I didn't call you.
Hmm.
And I was so nervous, I handed him the remote control instead of the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And he called up, and sure enough, it was Smith Road.
So your 911 was mapped to the wrong address.
Yeah.
By the phone company.
And they were threatening me.
Amazing.
About the false report. And I can only imagine. Oh, they didn't even apologize when they left. But I can only imagine the people that go through this on a daily basis. It's got to be terrible for them.
Yeah.
And that was one incident. Then there was another incident being in a rural area. My barn was being vandalized. And I sat and argued with the dispatcher for 15 minutes to get a cop up there, and they wouldn't send anybody. So I went down and the next day, and I went to the barracks, and I talked to someone. I said, how come nobody came? And the cop said, oh, we would have come out. That's overtime for us, you know, because after midnight, they're not dispatched. So that was that, and left it alone. That night, my son's coming home from sports practice, gets pulled over. You're Valerie's son, aren't you? And they hand him a parking ticket.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's so, punishment.
You can only imagine, if, you know, this is, Vermont's the whitest state in the nation.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, this is not an issue of race. This is an issue of police abuse of power. Valerie, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So nobody's wanted to talk about Scotland or their iPhone being their credit card, but we've got a lot of good, interesting stories here. Stick around. Welcome back. Matthew in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Matthew, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was calling about a couple incidents that have happened. Well, there's quite a few of them in my life, but two of them that that entail something that I've noticed, and one of them is initiation. I went to a tavern on my birthday as a celebration, and as I left, I was walking home, and from out of nowhere, I wound up on the ground by the police. They were initiating a new candidate or whatever the new police officer would be, and she did a flying drop kick to my back.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I wound up in jail for disorderly conduct. Now, I had $100 on me that was given to me as a gift, and when I was released without my shoes because they said that I was being disorderly, so they took my shoes, but nobody could find them, I had to walk home barefoot and check my wallet, and the $100 was gone. That would entail the initiation event, but there was also another one, is intimidation. I got pulled over by the police one time, and their squad walked up to my window, got my license, and went back to his car. And the next thing I know, there's another squad, and then another squad, and then a couple paddy wagons, and they all pull out their weapons and they're pointing them at me, and I'm totally freaked out and scared, so I freeze my hands to the steering wheel, and they say, get out of the car. And I said, no, I'm not going to move. I don't know what's going on. Why are you pointing weapons at me? And another officer walks up to the car real snakily, real quietly, opens up my door and pulls me out of the car and throws me onto the ground. And to find out that they claimed there was a robbery in the neighborhood, my car matched the identity. To go home, I was going home after work, and when I finally got home, I explained to my wife, now ex-wife, what had happened, and she freaked out, and we packed up all of our stuff in the house, and we moved to another city. to find out that she was having an affair with a detective. And he had these police spotting me and to intimidate me so that he could have her.
Wow.
So these things, and I worked for police probably off and on for the last 25 years in home remodeling, and I've listened to many, many stories of these two the things, but the worst one is the initiation.
So this is like a gang initiation? You become a new police officer and you got to go out and commit a crime?
Well, they'll be called on something, but they escalate it by picking out certain people and initiating their new police officers by saying, this is what you got to do.
Wow.
And it goes beyond just like a drop kick that they did to me, and it knocked me out. But it goes beyond that. It goes to making up stories and making sure that your story sticks. I mean, there's a whole gamut of things that they do. They're all not all bad police, but it's still pushed on them. The good police are even forced, in some instances, to do things that is distasteful to them.
Amazing story, man. Thank you for the call. Yeah, this is, we need to be focusing on the good cops and figuring out a way to empower them and pay them better and make our police departments work. We'll do that. Amazing. We just had a caller talk about how in Milwaukee, I think it was, he had been beat up by a police officer who was new to the force, and that was part of an initiation process, like gang initiation. And then, you know, when he gets off the phone during the break, Shano said, this way the other cops have something on that new cop. So if that new cop decides to ever squeal on them, they've got something that they can. This is too much like gang culture for me. It's very strange. JC in Fort Huachuca, Arizona.
I'm at Fort Lewis now, man.
Okay.
How you doing, Tom?
Hey, what's up, JC?
Yeah, I was gonna make a comment. I guess I don't know where to start, but I'll make a comment concerning the guest that you had on. I've called in a couple of times before, and I just kind of find it funny when I hear men, subscribe to this notion of what, you know, masculinity and machismo and all these things are supposed to be. I'm a ranger in the 3rd Ranger Battalion, and people who normally talk like that have some type of deep-seated, you know, weakness that they feel that they have to compensate for.
Yeah.
And if they push that on their children, it's worse because the idea is perpetuated. And the reason I make the point of me being in the military is because those same individuals who talk all that big game and deal these things, when it actually comes down to fighting, they have nothing to say. I don't think that it makes me any less of a man to be empathetic or sympathetic to other people. I guess the same guy would think that my squad leader, who is a gay man, openly gay man in 3rd Battalion, is not much of a man because, you know, he's a gay man, you know. And, by the way, my girlfriend happens to make 20 times more than I do because the military doesn't pay much, but that's not why I do it. So I guess by his default definition of what masculinity is, I guess I'm not much of a man either. Yeah. But I would challenge him to say that to my face.
Yeah, there you go. This is why, when all these Ted Nugent was running around with his guns and all this other stuff and all these guys doing this open carry stuff, we created the Small Penis Gun Club. And it's over at smallpenisgunclub.org, I believe, or .net. We have a website for it. And it's just, you know, it seems to me like you said, these guys are compensating for something, and maybe that's it.
I don't know if it just doesn't go that, I mean, that easy, but I don't understand what
it's probably much more complex.
Women would be attracted to that type of person who seems like they have to put other people down or compare themselves constantly to other people's ideas in order to make them seem like they're bigger and better than someone else.
Yeah.
And on the last thing that you said concerning, I guess, good and bad police, it's just like any other job. I have some people in my life who are, you know, been in law enforcement, and you have people who are jerks in any other job. You have people who are jerks in police department. The difference is you know, a lot of times in those jobs, you know, it's not necessarily a life and death situation. If there's more accountability, then I think things would be a lot better. You know, I think, you know, if we start holding these police commissioners really, you know, to the fire, and these people get out and vote instead of just, you know, having a bunch of anger, you know, vote on these people who, you know, empower these commissioners who allow these individuals to do these reprehensible things in the name of the law. That's not appropriate.
Yeah.
That's the only comment I have on that, Tom.
Yeah, you said it very well, JC. I totally agree with you. Thanks for the call. Diana in Poinette, Wisconsin. Hey, Diana, you wanted to talk about Doug's comments about how feminists want to destroy all men?
Yeah, I think he's a hypocrite, and he's out to make a lot of money like his daughter. I don't know what she does, but the reason I think he is he, it doesn't pertain to his family, whatever's in his book. He didn't want to talk about it, and I think he's feeding the frenzy out there. He's just one of those people that are throwing out all the negative and the confusion in an already confused world, and I wish people would just live and let live and not listen to these people.
Well, let me give you the I think the bigger picture to this, Diana. In 1981, when Reagan became president, we had, from the conservative point of view, we had a problem in the United States, and that was that people of color, young people, women, gay people, just, you know, immigrants right across the span of humanity, with the exception of white males, were getting too uppity. And from Watts burning to the women's rights movement, the feminist movement in the 60s, to all this stuff. And so they were like, okay, we will dial this back by cutting the wealth of the working class. And you cut the wealth of the working class and you destroy their political power. And because now they're just basically slaves to their employers. And so, you know, Reaganomics, starting in 81 to today, has elevated the very wealthy and destroyed basically the American middle class. It's now been replaced by the working poor. And we've gone from one home, you know, one person in a family working to, you know, the average family having over three jobs in it. Actually, I think it's 2.7 now. And this is, you know, this is a radical change. And then when these, by and large, white men start discovering that their pay is a half of what it used to be, they can't keep up with the credit cards, they can't keep up with their house payments, they're feeling like their role as a homemaker or provider has been destroyed, then the conservatives come along and say, yeah, you're right, and you know whose fault it is? Those women.
Yeah, that's a bunch of crap.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, Diana. But that's how it's played, and that's this. You're a victim of women. You're a victim of people of color who want your job. You're a victim of Hispanic immigrants who want your job. You're the victim. You know, when in fact the white working class and pretty much the entire working class of the United States has been destroyed not by women, not by people of color, but by and large, rich Republicans. And they would love it if we all fought with each other. Diana, you make a great point. Thank you very much for the call. So it's been a great day. It's amazing how time flies. We will be back tomorrow with more. And don't forget, I will be this Friday, I'll be in Seattle at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall. You can get tickets and information over at yesmagazine.org. Yes Magazine is putting this on, yesmagazine.org. And hope to see you on Friday if you're in the Seattle area. Otherwise, I will see you tomorrow right here. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You got to show up. You got to participate, in particular in this upcoming election. Tag yours. We'll see you. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.